Welcome to the Logic Consortium. Today on the show, we welcome back Professor Noam Chomsky. We're going to be asking him about whether he thinks that globalization in the abstract is antithetical to the left. We're going to be talking about economics and capitalism and whether it really has the benefits that some people talk about in creating wealth. Then we're going to be talking about anti-Semitism. And lastly, we're going to be talking about some of the U.S. population's views towards the detainees in Guantanamo. We conducted this interview in September of 2009, just last week. So please stick around. Thanks so much for joining us. Okay, I first wanted to ask you about globalization and the integration of economies through trade, foreign direct investment, capital flows, etc., and whether this idea is necessarily antithetical to the left. And when I'm defining the left, I'm defining it as those who are interested in expanding the opportunities for the masses and the ordinary citizens. Because it seems that many people who are speaking out against globalization are sometimes expressing their discontent over the general concept and not necessarily only the specific problems with its current practices. And I know in a recent interview you mentioned how trade and investment could give South America more opportunities. And on this show before, you mentioned how some of the ideas of globalization might be a good idea, but they have only a weak relationship to what we're actually seeing. Could you maybe comment on whether you think that globalization is antithetical to the left?
It depends entirely on what form that it takes. Globalization has always been basically a slogan of the left, an ideal of the left. That's why every union is called an international. They aren't actually internationals, but that's what they strove to be. In fact, there were several efforts, abortive as they turned out, to construct internationals on the left. Every year there's a meeting of the World Social Forum, country of the South, one or another. The World Social Forum is a perfect example of globalization. It brings together people from all over the world, all walks of life, working seriously on issues that are of great significance to the peoples of the world. It often meets alongside the Via Campesina, the International Peasants Association, which actually its fundamental base is the majority of the population of the world. Well, that's all globalization in the literal sense of the term, meaning integration of people with varied interests but common concerns, quite often, to develop plans, programs, and activities that are of benefit to the population of the world. Well, that kind of globalization is very beneficial to the left. It's why it's, in fact, initiated by the left and has always been. What's technically called globalization, however, is something different. It's a specific form of international economic integration that's designed for the interests of the designers, not surprisingly. The designers are multinational corporations, international financial institutions, the few states that primarily cater to their interests and are largely controlled by them. And that does yield a particular form of international economic integration. Now, since they happen to have most of the power in the world in their hands, they also have the power to define issues. So their form of globalization is called globalization, and the form of the globalization that's oriented towards the needs of people of flesh and blood is called anti-globalization. But there's no reason to fall into that ideological trap. Whether globalization is beneficial to the left or not depends on what form it takes, what goals it has, how it's implemented. Same is true of what's called trade, which you mentioned. First of all, trade, like most terms of political, economic, and social discourse, has two meanings. I mean, there's a technical meaning and a meaning that's used for basically ideological warfare. In the way the term trade is used, it covers a wide variety of interactions which would not be called trade by any sensible definition of the word. And we know that. So, for example, take, say, the old Soviet Union. If parts were made in, Leningrad and shipped to Warsaw for assembly and turned into cars, and the cars were sold, say, in Moscow, it would cross borders in both directions, but we wouldn't call it trade because it's interactions within a command economy. And the fact that it happens to cross borders is maybe a bit advantageous to the people who are managing it, but it doesn't make it trade. Well, suppose that General Motors produces parts in Indiana, sends them to northern Mexico for assembly, turning them into cars, and sells the cars in Los Angeles. Well, those are interactions internal to a command economy. So just as in the case of the old Soviet Union, we shouldn't call it trade. But it is called trade. It crosses borders in two directions, so it's called trade. It's just interactions internal to a command economy called General Motors. And the shifts are in order for them to maximize profit, to produce at the lowest labor cost with the least environmental standards and so on. Now, that's not a small proportion of what's called trade. In fact, corporations are essentially totalitarian entities. They don't give us much information about what they're doing. But it seems that, say, between the United States and Mexico, that's on the order of 50%, maybe more, of what's called trade. And if we bring in other factors like outsourcing and so on, it would rise even higher. So a large part of what's called trade, maybe even the majority of it, is not trade at all in any serious sense of the word. And when we ask whether trade is good or bad, we can't overlook these facts. That's a huge part of the question. So that kind of trade may be good for the the investors in General Motors, but it's not good for the workforces and communities in U.S. manufacturing towns. So we ask who benefits, who pays, who determines. And very typically it's the people who make the decisions who benefit those sectors. Again, not surprisingly. Well, these are the kinds of questions we have to ask all the time before we can talk seriously about globalization. It's impossible. Without going into these kinds of issues, it's almost meaningless to ask the general question whether globalization is good or bad. It depends on a lot of factors.
You're listening to The Logic Consortium in our interview with Professor Noam Chomsky that was conducted in September of 2009. So please stick around. Thanks so much. Staying with economics for a moment, while markets have many inefficiencies, as you've mentioned and many others have mentioned, in that they underprice externalities, and with our market economy, so many people discount how much of a role government spending has had as being an engine of growth with its basic research in so many areas that the private sector is really allowed to piggyback off of. Many still argue that a free market and capitalist system can be very beneficial to the population, because the amount of wealth that can help create in a society. And with this wealth, a proper social safety net can be created, where people can explore their creative ideas and have health care and education. Could you comment on this idea that, wealth can be generated so with capitalism, and so a proper social safety net can be created?
Well, you've sort of posed the question in an internally contradictory way, which makes it pretty hard to answer. So you pointed out that there are very vast interferences in the market, state interferences, intervention in the market, such as research and development. That's not a footnote. That's the core of the advanced economy. So computers, the internet, lasers, containers, which are the basis for trade, airplanes, on and on. We don't have much of an economy without the pharmaceuticals, the biotechnology. There's a huge public input into all of this. To a very substantial extent, the system is based on the principle that the public pays the costs and takes the risks, and profits eventually privatized. Now, the scale is substantial. You know, how to measure it exactly is complicated, but there's no doubt that it's substantial. So, and that being the case, we can't talk about free markets because they're vastly distorted in these and other ways. Now, in addition to that, they have many inefficiencies. So underpricing, say, systemic risk, externalities, that's not a footnote. We're right in the middle of a massive financial crisis, which is largely a predicted and predictable result of the consistent underpricing of systemic risk. And there are other major inefficiencies. So, for example, we have a serious environmental crisis. Everyone's aware of that. There are fundamental market inefficiencies which make it extremely difficult to deal with it. I mean, to put it in simple terms, as economists do when they talk about producing widgets and so on, I have to get home from work tonight. Well, the market offers me some choices, say a Ford or a Toyota. It doesn't offer me a choice between a car and a subway. That's not, the market simply doesn't provide that choice. A subway is a collective decision. In a democratic society, it would be by decision of the population. And that's not a market choice. That's a choice taken by radical interference in the market. And again, it's not a footnote. Unless we move from our highly wasteful dependence on fossil fuels, which is stimulated by state corporate propaganda and social engineering, unless we move from that, there isn't going to be much of a future to talk about. So again, I just can't answer the question. It's posed in terms that abstract away from too many factors that critically enter into providing a sensible response. Now, there are respects in which there are aspects of markets in our society. You can question just what their scale is, but they certainly exist. You know, they have a certain, sometimes they create wealth, sometimes they create waste. That's hard, not simple calculation either. Do they provide incentives? Yeah, in some ways, but the non-market system also provides incentives. So take, say, the technological and scientific work on which much of the modern economy is based. Well, to the extent that that's produced, say, in government laboratories, under universities, and so on, there's very little in the way of market incentives. I mean, maybe some. If somebody wants to start a small company somewhere. But the main work is done just by people who are interested in it, and that's their reward. Nobody, Einstein didn't produce his work because he was getting shares in a corporation. And that's, again, not a footnote. That's the core of serious work. So there are lots of kinds of incentives. And we all know that from our personal lives. We don't spend our lives trying to maximize personal wealth or other gain. Or if we do, we're pathological. So maybe the right kind of system that would be beneficial to humans and maybe even necessary to ensure some kind of a decent future, maybe it would have market elements in it. Maybe, I don't think that's impossible. In fact, maybe it's likely. But it has to be a nuanced response, bringing in many different considerations.
Switching gears a little bit, when talking about the Arab-Israeli landscape among among Jewish people, there's sometimes a mention of anti-Semitism that exists. And for this reason, Israelis and Jews need to be especially careful in their actions and in their foreign policy, or we might see the repeat of some serious problems, etc. Could you comment on this at all?
Well, anti-Semitism has been in the past an extremely serious issue. I mean, we can't forget the history of Europe. I grew up in the United States, but through childhood and actually through my college and graduate student years, I saw plenty of it. It declined very significantly, say, in American life. It's there, but it's a very marginal factor in American life since, say, the 1960s. On the other hand, it can increase, and I think the actions of Israel are likely to, in fact, already are, increasing anti-Semitism. I mean, Israel, after all, claims to be the state of all Jews. It's the sovereign. Its basic law says we are the sovereign state of the Jewish people in Israel and in the diaspora. And the Jewish community typically acts that way. Well, you can't have that commitment and try to sharply separate the actions of Israel from the attribution of what it does to Jews. I think it's wrong to do so, but Israel basically insists on it. And people who identify with Israel are insisting on that too. And in fact, the same thing happened in other ways. So one of Israel's leading statesmen, most respected statesman, Abba Eman, about 25 years ago, I suppose, wrote an article in an American Jewish journal directed to American Jews, in which he explained to them what their task was. And their task, he said, was to show that criticisms of Zionism, by which, of course, he meant criticisms of the state of Israel and its policies, they were to show that these criticisms either result from anti-Semitism or from neurotic, self-hating Jews, it's an injunction which has the nice property that it includes 100% of criticism and wipes it out. He gave some examples of the neurotic, self-hating Jews. There were two, in fact. One was me and one was I.F. Stone. Okay, if that's the way an Israeli statesman wants to define the problem, yeah, there's going to be a lot of anti-Semitism around as he's defining it. Because there's a lot of legitimate criticism of the state of Israel and its policies, as of other states. If you want to hide behind the veil of anti-Semitism and say, okay, it's legitimate because it's illegitimate because it's anti-Semitism, you're simply saying, I declare that there must be and will be a tremendous wave of anti-Semitism in the world. But that's self-generated. Those are critical factors. On the other hand, you can't ignore the consequences of it, even if Israel and its enthusiasts are helping to increase anti-Semitism, as they are, it still is a danger which can have effects. In the United States, it doesn't happen. It used to be a major issue. It isn't much anymore, but it could be again, and same elsewhere.
My friend Omer, who was with us in our last interview, who couldn't make the interview today, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the public reaction to the people being held in Guantanamo Bay. As you pointed out, in many situations, public opinion differs quite substantially from government policy. In areas such as healthcare, expansive U.S. foreign policy, and many other areas. But with the people being held in Gitmo, even though there is not enough evidence to bring formal charges against these people, the public still seems to retain strong sentiments against the detainees. Could you maybe give a comment on this?
Well, first of all, we have to remember that this is and always has been a very frightened country. it goes way back in American history to the earliest days. Major themes in popular American literature from the days of the colonists have been fear. We're about to be attacked by serious enemy, terrible enemies. We have to somehow defend ourselves. So people are trying to take things from us. And that's a deep strain. That's why people didn't laugh in the United States when Ronald Reagan strapped on his cowboy boots and announced declared a national emergency because of the threat to our national security posed by the government of Nicaragua, which has troops only 2 days away from Texas. I mean, in a sane society, people would have collapsed in ridicule, but not here. It passed. Or similarly, to go to the other end of the political spectrum, in, I guess it must have been 1966 or so, Lyndon Johnson made a speech in which he said something like this. It was about the war in Vietnam. He said, there's 150 million of us, and there are 3 billion of them, the rest of the world. And if might takes right, makes right, they'll sweep over us and take what we have. So we have to defend ourselves here in Vietnam. Well, again, you know, it's a pretty remarkable statement. I don't have to comment on that. But it did not elicit ridicule. Rather, it expressed deeply held sentiments. Johnson was probably speaking very honestly, kind of a man of the people. And that's the kind of sentiment you find in a guy who grew up in Texas. Well, those are, and we can go on. I mean, those are major strains in American culture. And they show up in fear of immigrants, fear of foreign enemies, fear of narco traffickers, non-existent weapons of mass destruction, and so on. And yes, they show up in fear of people in Guantanamo. Why are they in Guantanamo in the first place? I mean, how come they weren't? First of all, it's a serious question about why most of them were even picked up. But putting that aside, if you think you have a case against them, it's clear what to do. Put them in a prison in the United States, say in New York State if you want. Can be a maximum security prison, so there's no threat whatsoever. And give them, grant them the rights of any prisoners. So if you have evidence against them, bring them to trial in a fair court, not a military court. And with the proper provisions that are provided in such cases by international law and domestic law. If you don't have evidence against them, let them go. That's what should be done. And you don't have to let them go in New York City. You can let them go wherever you kidnap them from, say Pakistan or wherever it might be. Well, that would be the sensible response. Since the government didn't make that response, and we know exactly why. If they were put in Gitmo, the reason is not security, because you could have just as good security in New York. The reason is that it was believed by the government that that would place them beyond the reach of American and international law. In other words, they were put there because it was intended to be a torture chamber. There's no reason to be surprised by the reports of torture that came out. That's implicit in putting them in Guantanamo in the first place. Incidentally, why in Guantanamo? What right do we have to put anybody in Guantanamo? Guantanamo was essentially stolen from Cuba back in 1902 at the point of a gun. There is a treaty, but the treaty was signed by Cuba under occupation at the point of a gun, so illegitimate treaty. And that treaty permits the U.S. to use Guantanamo as a naval base and a coaling station, not as a torture chamber, not as a place to put prisoners. So we're doing it in violation of an illegitimate treaty forced on the people of Cuba. I mean, how can this go on in a country that has even minimal concerns for human rights and justice? Well, the answer is can't, which tells us something important about our own culture and society. But to go back to your question, people are afraid. It's a fear that's partially induced. Fears. So yes, terrorism is a danger, definitely. But that's true of even the person who thinks someone's chasing him with an axe probably has some reason for it. Those are serious questions about ourselves that have to be faced.
You're listening to The Logic Consortium, and that was our interview with Professor Noam Chomsky, talking about a number of different issues, from globalization to anti-Semitism to Guantanamo Bay to capitalism. So thanks so much for listening today, and please go on our blog if you have a comment, a compliment, or if you don't like something that we said, please let us know at logicconsortium.blogspot.com. And thanks so much to Matt Hudson and Scientific Map for Fear for Disappear. Have a great day, everybody.